Hi, welcome to Outrageous, our bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, media, politics, culture, and everything in between. Yet again, I'm joined by my two very best friends, Trisha in LA.
Hello.
And Jason in DC.
Hey there.
How's it going, guys?
It's going
it's
all
good.
Right. The order in which you say those words that you say in the intro, is there a logic to it?
I started saying it one way, like early on, and I just think like as like an intro, like an opening credits thing, like it just should always be the same thing. But now I know for a fact I mix it up. I know for a fact I say it differently because I felt it on my tongue. It didn't feel the same. But no, but it, all four of them are in there: race, media, politics, culture. I think I say politics first. Politics, race, media, culture.
No, you always start with race.
Do I always start with race?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course you do.
Do
yeah,
I?
You always start with, well, because it's a natural start. When you start with
race,
politics,
media,
yeah, you always have race, media, because race and media are two of the things that we talk mostly about generally.
Probably,
and then
yeah.
The politics piece kind of comes in naturally in the culture.
Oh, I don't know. I think we talk about politics. I'm going to look back. I think like this is the 9th episode. I think we talk about politics at least.
We talk about
it's
it.
An election year.
It's an election year. I think that's a big
election
part
year.
I,
and,
I,
and Trisha's boyfriend, Bernie Sanders, is running, so. So it's a lot of discussion about him.
You all are very fortunate to be talking to me today. So let me just...
Oh, wow. Thank you.
No. Listen, this is what happened. So this morning, like I've been mentioning, I just wake up now naturally at 6 a.m., which I find horrendous, but I guess it's aging. And I'm laying in my bed, and I'm actually reading fan fiction. I won't say which. And
please say
and I
which.
Hear,
wait, did
I
you
hear,
say fan fiction?
Yes, she
yeah,
did.
Fan fiction.
I don't know what that means.
Why don't you explain it, Trisha?
Are stories
like
written
fiction?
By fans of TV shows, movies, where they put the characters in stories together. You know, original characters meant for one medium. Say, for example, that someone just went out and saw the movie Civil War, Captain America Civil War, and then they went home and said, you know, I really like the relationship that I see between Bucky and Steve. Why don't I write a story about those two people together? So that's fan fiction.
It's like the democratization of...
Kind of. I love it. I mean, there are lots of political ideas around it for people, but I love it. It's generally mostly written by women and all kinds of dynamics. Well, the subtext being also that they're usually romantic relationships between, you know, between two men or two women or however you want to do it. Anyway, so I'm just laying out in my bed reading, and I hear pow, 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 and I'm thinking, ugh, damn it. Wow, that's a car backfiring. That's weird. So I go about my business, I'm not thinking anything about it, and I leave my apartment, and I see police tape all around the block.
No,
my entire block has police tape.
No.
And, of course, my sister's Chatty Cathy, so she passes the cop, and she says, what happened? And he's like, oh, there was a shooting.
Jesus.
I'm like, wait a minute. The pop, pop, pop I heard this morning were actually gunshots. By the way, you know what? I don't know what it sounds like, but I have to say I have heard that sound before, so clearly gunshots happens in my neighborhood. It's actually not a bad neighborhood, so it's sort of horrendous that this is happening.
What
and
neighborhood
I was like,
do you live in?
I live in Van Nuys, but not the dodgy part. But then again, who knows? Maybe
sounds
it's all
like
dodgy.
You do live in the dodgy part.
Exactly. Just I like probably that. Do. So anyway, so then guess what? So then the cop says, oh, yeah, you know, he's okay, though. You know, his friend didn't kill him. I was like, wait a minute.
His
You're getting
friend.
Shot by a friend. So not only are people no, like, I mean, and the only thing I could think to myself was I was about to go down this road where I started thinking about, oh my God, should I move, blah, blah, blah. And then I was realizing, wait a minute. The only problem with this is that anyone can have a gun. And this could have easily happened anywhere. Because it's not a horrible neighborhood. It was happening in Studio City just like last year. Some guy just randomly decided to go shoot up a neighborhood. You know what I mean? So I was just like, well, you know what? All I was left to do was to shrug my shoulder and go, well, this is what happens when you live in a place where people, anyone can have a gun, and in the midst of a fight, you decide to take it out and use it. It was just the strangest thing.
Or not even. I read a story where at some graduation a while back, this man was just sitting in the bleachers and he went to go scratch his leg or something, hit a gun in his sock, it went off, it shot him through the foot, traveled, and hit some other woman.
Oh.
Yeah, just sitting at a graduation, because why not? Because when I leave the house, I usually stick a gun in my sock.
Strap.
What was he thinking?
Yeah, so well, the presence of guns everywhere.
My inference from your story, Trisha, is that the distinction between the dodgy part, as you put it, of Van Nuys and where you live is that in the dodgy part, you might get shot by a stranger who's trying to rob you.
Yes.
But in your neighborhood, you'll just get shot by a friend.
Yes. By a friend.
It's a friendly shooting neighborhood. It's
friendly fire.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's like you're just walking down the street, be like, hey, bitch, I like your blouse. Blam, blam. Oh, no, what happened?
Like or in the case of this man that I just read across the newsfeed this morning, who this woman turned him down because she had no interest in dating him, and he got so upset that he proceeded to shoot up her car and shot her 5-year-old.
Oh, that's awful.
She's alive.
That's awful, Jason.
It's all awful, right? I mean, it's just like, what? You gonna say no to me? Okay. And then it's so sad because then I'm reading it on this other website. This woman's like, maybe she should have said yes because he's wait. He's clearly a nice guy because, you know, that's the whole thing. Why did you reject me? I'm obviously a great guy. Well, I don't know. You just shot me. So.
I know.
I don't know.
Imagine if I said yes. What kind of levels of crazy would you have reached?
Anyway. Sorry, but yeah, so you are very happy that there are no stray bullets and they shot directly at each other.
I'm glad that you didn't get killed.
Yes, agreed.
So, thank you.
I think that every day when I come home, though, so that's kind of the way my mind goes now. I do. I'm always like, ooh, I made it home alive today.
Ugh.
Ooh, wow. That sounds like that's a downer, right? But
it sounds like a downer.
We're going to have to start with whatever is the most upbeat topic because I'm already depressed.
You know what? I wanted to ask you guys this question because I was talking to someone about this podcast and they they weren't so interested in our opinions about race, media, politics, or culture, but they were just vibing off the fact that we're in three corners of the country. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, God, do you guys ever discuss that? Like, you guys must be having completely different experiences. And I was like, well, no, you know, we just talk about our opinions. They're like, yeah, whatever. But anyway, it got me thinking, and I was like, okay, how can we highlight the fact that we live in three very different places? And then I got to thinking, I wanted to ask you guys this question. What do you think is the most overrated thing in the city you live in?
Probably celebrity culture. People automatically assume that if you live in LA, people automatically assume that you have seen a celebrity, that you access celebrity in your daily life. It's really a normal city.
Yeah, but you so don't. People, like, I feel like I don't access celebrities, but I see, you know, on the train and shit, they're going about their lives.
No.
And I feel like they go about their lives differently in LA.
Well, no, because, see, I think the difference between our cities is that New York is a public transportation city, and LA, you're in a car. So I would have to go to the celebrity to access it. Like, I'd have to go to a particular restaurant, yeah, go to a particular
design.
Area.
By design.
If I live my life normally, I don't necessarily have to. I could go to the Grove where I've taken you with the farmer's market, and necessarily you'll run into. So that's probably the closest.
Although I have to say at the Grove, I'm always like, come on, Mariah Carey. What do you want to go to, Barnes & Noble's, American Girl place? Jason, you ever been to the Grove? It's just a mall. Like,
it's an outdoor mall.
I haven't been there, no.
And it's like,
but
oh,
it's
I'm
like,
sorry.
I'm you sure need... there's one in every city now. They all have them that look like that, right, Chris? I mean, you can see a Grove anywhere.
I mean, anywhere where the weather is always good, yeah. I would say the most overrated thing in New York right now is the High Line. It got built, and it's this beautiful...
Oh, I'm like dying to see it. It's overrated.
Really? It's this beautiful park on the west side of Manhattan. Yeah. It's like an old railroad line,
right.
Freight line that they put plants and trees and stuff up there. It's intriguing as an idea, but to actually go to the High Line and walk up and down, because several thousand people are doing it at the same time, it feels like a bit of a forced march. There's people directly behind you and directly in front of you, and you have got to keep pace. And you're keeping pace for blocks because there's nothing to do but walk straight ahead. And in the summer, it's brutal because there's not a lot of shade up there, and it's just hot. I don't know. People are always like, let's go see the High Line. I'm like, what? Anyway. I was like, why would you want to do that? It's not a comfortable thing. And the views, meh. I'll say that.
What about you, Jason?
You know, I'm struggling with this because I'm such a nerd. Like, I love DC. I think everything's underrated. Like, I love the museum, the Smithsonian museums. Like, I love it all. The only thing I would say is overrated, which you could probably say this in a lot of cities, is brunch. Like, these restaurants brunch. It's like, oh, Is it really brunch? That exciting? You know, like,
yes,
like
brunch is fantastic.
Why?
Love brunch. We Jason. Subscribe to brunch.
I don't. Jason.
Our friendship was built over brunch.
Yeah, you guys really had a whole shameless brunch thing that you guys did.
About, oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
Shame-free brunch. Remember, Trisha? We did that for years.
But yeah, I have not. I was not raised on a brunch culture, and I don't. It's like it's a lot of money, and it's like it's not food's not really good for you, and it breaks up Sunday, where it's like you can't really do anything else. You end up being like really full.
Well, that's what you're doing all day, Jason. Just think this is what brunch is. Imagine this conversation, but with some delicious waffles and mimosas. That's all brunch is. It's friends chatting about stuff for hours. How could you? Who comes down against that?
I do. I'm against it.
That was your answer. You think brunch is overrated in D.C.?
I honestly do. I honestly do. Like
not the White House, but brunch.
No, the White House.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't think any of the monuments are overrated.
I think they are amazing. I could go to them every day. I do not tire of hosting people in D.C. and taking them to the monuments. I could do it all the time.
Well, people, take him up on that offer.
Whew. Yeah,
yeah. Here I am.
Everyone, run to D.C. and
I'd
contact
be happy
Jason.
To show you around. My kids and I will give you the best tour you've ever had.
All right, let's jump into this and let's get started. Before we do, shout out to Rosenny. Hey, Rosenny.
We love you, Rosenny. Sorry
we love
if
you,
I
Rosenny.
That was a Rosenny ad.
Yeah, that was this part is paid for by Rosenny.
our first sponsor is Rosenny.
Our friend Rosenny, she knows all three of us very well, and she lives in D.C., and she just started listening to the podcast, which is weird. And we just want to say hello, and we will take you up on the meal offer. She's going to cook us all dinner, so we're going to do that.
When's that happening?
When next time we're all in D.C.
Which will be
this fall, probably.
August/September.
Oh, all right.
We'll record live. That time. So hi, Rosenny. Okay, so let's get into what we were talking about. I'm going to start tonight.
Ooh.
I know.
Take the bull by the horn.
Really
Let's just get started.
Jump in.
So a couple weeks back, So a couple of weeks back, 24-year-old rapper Azalea Banks went on a Twitter rant against Zayn Malik, he of the former One Direction, where she said a lot of racist and homophobic things in response to an experienced slight that wasn't even about her. Then 14-year-old Sky Jackson, who is some sort of Disney Muppet, rose to defend him on Twitter. And then Azalea Banks ripped into her, this child, calling her all sorts of names that I'm not going to repeat, insulting her mother, and going on and on and on until Twitter banned Azalea Banks. This in and of itself, I think, is an interesting topic. But what I find really interesting about this whole event is on the internet, like the cultural, whatever, it's like the swamp of opinions. But a lot of people are defending Azalea Banks and saying that she mustn't be silenced. This is a free speech issue. This is about racism and misogyny. Because she's a black woman, they're trying to silence her. And what it got me thinking between that and here, and also with extensions to Bill Cosby, is that in this environment of Black Lives Matter, now that we are exposing white supremacy, as we are exposing like the history, the crushing weight that black people have had to live under in this country, is bad behavior now racially contextualized? Can we excuse bad behavior by citing someone's race or history? And does that apply in Azalea Banks case? Does that apply in the Bill Cosby case? Will that apply to some other future cases? So I guess my question is, are black people really personally responsible for anything that they're doing?
What?
I
just wanted to get a reaction out of you. But
you know, like Fox News, like
far.
What just happened? Like,
I know that was too far. But you know, that's going. I
like how you said they too. Like suddenly you're not black just for this question.
I just wanted to put it. I just really wanted to see how you guys would react to that. But that is
atrocious.
But But that is my question now. Like, how do we understand, like, the bank situation in this new environment where we are talking about these things openly? What is too far?
Well, you know, I read some articles that you sent and some others about the reactions to banks. And I feel the ones that I saw didn't so much make the argument. Like, the argument that I saw was double standard, that there are other people on Twitter whose behavior is equally awful and who are not banned. And so now you may disagree with that. I don't participate in Twitter enough to have an opinion about that. But if it's a question of a double standard, I think there's a conversation to be had. Maybe it's not she shouldn't have been banned. Maybe it's more people should be banned. Like, I don't know what the answer to that is. But I don't know. I mean, to me, if there's a double standard, there's a conversation to be had. If it's just if the question is, do black people get a pass for certain awful behavior because of the history of white supremacy, I mean, I think we would probably agree that there's a line that, like, no one should get a pass for certain behavior, regardless of history. Trisha?
Twitter's funny. Because, first of all, you really don't access Azalea Banks unless you're following Azalea Banks, right? That's the thing about it. There are lots of choices. If you think of Twitter like you think of a TV and each person that's on Twitter as a specific channel, you basically sign on for each channel that you choose to follow. So I don't know what Azalea Banks is doing on Twitter because I'm not following her. So on some level, there is a kind of, you have the right to do what you want to do on Twitter. And if I say something on my timeline and you don't like it, you could, the perfect example is you can just unfollow me. I don't like you, so I'm unfollowing you. Fine. Now, I think in Azalea Banks' situation, her situation is that she is specifically attacking people on Twitter. So I don't know if Zane was even following her, but she sought him out and then went at him, similar to Shay Jackson, right?
Sky,
is that her name? Sky Jackson. I don't know her. I don't know Disney kids. I didn't even know about her until the whole thing went down. And, you know, people were talking about Azalea Banks. Now, the thing about Azalea Banks is Azalea Banks has historically been unpleasant for quite some time. Yeah. So,
historically unpleasant. That's like a great epitaph.
I know. And, you know, even within her, like, unpleasantness, she's often had really great points, right? So, but I find it interesting that it was this occasion that caused her suspension. That seemed really strange to me because I think she's gone even further. But I don't know if it's the fact that the young girl is underage, if she's 14. Then again, the question that comes, why are you on Twitter at 14? But whatever. And then the other thing is Zayn, maybe it's because he's a One Direction member or former member and there's enough sort of like cachet on Twitter. You know, One Direction can get anything trending. So maybe that's why she emerged out of it. But I'm on Twitter a lot and people say horrendous things. Horrendous. Daily. Weekly. By minute. And so I don't understand what was the tipping point to make this suspension happen. That's what's really unclear to me.
So you think it is a double standard? I'm sorry to interrupt, but it sounds like you're saying there is a double standard.
Well, it's not even so much a double standard. My question is, like, how did it rise to the level of suspension? Is it because more people saw it? Is it because it was covered on the news? Like, was it about the content of what she was saying? Because people are saying worse. I mean, people have gotten on Twitter and called the president horrible names. They've called it to his face. To his face in the sense that they put it in their Twitter handle and address it to him. People have threatened other folks on Twitter. I mean, there's been a lot of abuse on Twitter. That happens. So I'm just trying to figure out, is it about people suddenly seeing it on television that makes it a big deal? Because otherwise, Twitter should be going through lots of people's timelines and sweeping it for different languages and then just saying, you've used offensive language.
Here's a question from Grandpa, because I don't use Twitter. If I Twitter at you, Trisha, I'm kidding. I know it's called tweeting. If I tweet at you and I include your handle, right, that appears on your
Yes, page? I can see it. And anyone who follows me traditionally you can might see be able it. To see
that,
it.
And that's why the follow okay. argument you were making, Trisha, I don't totally agree with because...
Yeah. Because then that's a little different. But to get at what you're saying here, people definitely do say terrible things on Twitter all the time. You know, I think there was a skit on one of the earlier episodes this season of Amy Schumer's show where it was all about, you know, Twitter introduces the new I'm going to rape and kill you button because it will save people a lot of time. You know what I mean? And it was like this whole joke about like all the abuse that women come under on Twitter. Now, you saying like maybe it should Twitter be sweeping everyone's pages or whatever they're called for offensive language. I don't know if they don't. I think Azalea Banks getting banned became public knowledge because she's Azalea Banks and everyone involved here was famous. Now, that one asshole sports fan who wants to tweet the president, I don't know why I made him a sports fan. Sorry for everyone who likes sports, but I have this picture in my head of the kind of person who's going to tweet terrible things at the president.
Baseball cap.
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe Twitter does then ban him, but we don't hear about it because he's just one asshole out of millions. And maybe Twitter is routinely going around banning people. Now, I don't know, and I know neither do you guys, so we don't need to go on that road.
But I just want to point it out. Mm-hmm. We can, though, Chris. I'll just say that one of the reasons why you do see quite a bit of women talking about their experiences on Twitter is that in their perception, Twitter doesn't do it at all. Because they're constant. I mean, there are people who've threatened at Deray McKesson on Twitter, and you know, what I mean, like your only recourse is to block them, and so hopefully you don't see them. But sometimes people can change their identity and they come back. So my sense of what I'm getting from some of the written pieces outside of Twitter is that in fact Twitter is not doing that. That women do feel like they're being assaulted. So in some weird way, I think you're right. I think it's really just the fame issue.
Well, absolutely, because Twitter is in the Twitter is in the public space now. Like, we're talking about Twitter alongside words like racism and homophobia. This is bad business for Twitter. Like, they have to do something. Now, that one random sports fan I talked about earlier, like, he's not famous, and him saying terrible things every day doesn't get the public's attention in the same way, other than that we all understand that the Twitterverse is a really terrible, horrible place.
Except Donald Trump. Donald Trump is very well known, and he retweets things that I wouldn't necessarily see because I'm not following white supremacists. Mm-hmm. And that gets public attention. You know what I mean? And his Twitter account has never been suspended. And that's even more egregious and dangerous in my mind.
I think that's actually the best comparison that I've heard people. You know, I think comparing Azalea Banks to some random sports fan, oh God, I'm going to catch shit about this. I think comparing Azalea Banks to some rando out there is the wrong comparison because of the fame issue. But you're right with the Donald Trump thing. But that's not actually the road I want to go down with this conversation. In the defense of Banks, a lot of people are saying, like, as a black woman, she's got the chips against her. You know, whatever rage that she has now is, you know, it's 2016. She needs to be able to express that in a way, and we need to understand it in context. Now, I want to know where you guys fall on that. And this whole time I've been thinking about this. I don't know if you two remember, but Real World Miami back in the 90s or the early part of this century, they had some on the Real World, they had this flower child woman who went out to a skate park, and she was a white woman. She met like these two or three black teenagers, and she invited them back to their posh Star Island, I think it was on Star Island mansion. And the kids proceeded to wreck the place and jump on the furniture or whatever, and one of the other white cast members came over and said, "Yo, what the fuck are you doing?" And the flower child white girl was like, no, they've been oppressed their whole life. Ugh. Like, you know, this is what they're doing. Like, we need to be comfortable with it. And I was like, wait, what exactly are you saying? That this is your expectation of them, that they should destroy this place just because they've been introduced to it, and you're saying that's just what black people should do? Because in some way, that's extraordinarily offensive.
Mm-hmm. So, are people using that as a defense for Azalea?
Yes. She's a black woman, and her rage can be justified because of what she has to deal with, racism, sexism, and the particular intersectional brand that black women deal with. This is a free speech issue. She needs to be able to put her her reality out there for us to see. It's ugly, but it exists. And I'm like, or she's a horrible person. I'm not, you know what I'm saying? But you know what I'm saying? But listen, this is out there. I just wonder what you guys think.
It's that's absolutely bottom basement thinking. And I would defend it if she was saying something thoughtful, critical, and based on her real experience. But that's not what she's doing. You know, initially, when I didn't have a problem with Azealia Banks because, like I said, she's historically unpleasant. And when I found her most useful is when
she's... I could just picture her tombstone. Here lies Azealia Banks. Historically unpleasant.
Exactly.
Look, no, I appreciated her when she was unmasking the music industry, giving us insight into the struggles that she has as an artist, as a black woman in that industry. But that doesn't excuse her essentially pointing to some random person, not random Zane, and then going on a rant, or going on a homophobic rant, which she did recently, or going on a rant against a child. I mean, she's not making any points then. She's just enraged. That's separate from her using the platform to attack racism, sexism, or any of those things. I would say fine if that was what she wanted to do, but that's not what she's doing. She's essentially just an unpleasant person in that moment being really cruel. She's not making it for any, she's not saying anything that's making a larger point. And just because she's been oppressed, listen, you know what she needs to do? Go speak to a minister, go see a therapist, do any of those kinds of situations, go talk to a friend. I mean, that's her responsibility. You can't go out and wound someone because you have been done damage to. That's different. She's not calling out the situation. She's not calling out the culture. She's not calling anything out. I can take her when she's doing that. Might not be my cup of tea, but I can take her when she's doing that. So I'm not taking her when she's attacking a 14-year-old.
So, Jason, is the public's takedown of Azealia Banks just one more example of white supremacy trying to silence black people?
No, I don't think so. No. I mean, I want to say a couple things. So, one, I'm not terribly familiar with her music, but the music I have heard from her, it's a shame that this is what she... It's a shame she's evoking so much attention for this behavior, because it seems like she actually has a lot of talent. So I just want to say that. Secondly, so the answer to your question, Chris, is no. I think what she has done is very problematic. I don't think it can be explained away by her lived experience or history or anything. All that said, and I know this may not be where you wanted to go with this conversation, but I sit here really amazed at the importance we give to Twitter and behavior on Twitter. I mean, her tweets to me were disgusting, but they were tweets. And that doesn't excuse them, but I'm just amazed that we're giving Twitter, and Twitter's just one example, Facebook, there are several things, Google, there are these companies that we now...
Wait, let me head you off at the pass.
Okay.
So if she had a press conference and said these things, you know, Zayn Malik is... I'm not going to repeat anything she said, actually, because I found a lot of it vile. But if she just had a press conference, and I have something to say, Zayn Malik is this, that, and the other, and his mother needs to da-da-da-da-da and da-da-da-da-da. What difference does it make? It's going to get reported, and Twitter just happens to be the 2016 way that celebrities get to speak for themselves.
Those who choose to spend a lot of time on lambasting certain behavior, comments that someone makes, while worthy of some response, just doesn't seem to me to rise to the level of calling for a ton. Neither what someone says on Twitter nor Twitter's reaction, neither what someone says in a press conference nor how the press reports it, I don't know.
I know what you're trying to say.
I'm going to cut you off at the pass, Jason, with this, because I think you're getting a little bit with the old age thinking. Let me show you something about Twitter.
Okay.
No, because I do understand.
School is
in
session.
No, because I know that people want to dismiss Twitter in the same way they want to dismiss things like Snapchat or any, because they're social media channels, and you're thinking to yourself, what the hell do they matter? But guess what? In some spaces they're replacing newspaper. And so one of the things that we have to understand is that Ferguson and news about Ferguson is only possible because of Twitter.
That's true.
It only rose to the level of public discourse because people were tweeting about it, yes. and it generated enough response to that other people in sort of quote unquote more legitimate spaces going, what is happening in Ferguson? Yes. And then suddenly CNN and all the other places are covering it. So part of the reason why I think it's important for us to have a conversation about Twitter and who gets shut down and who doesn't is think about what happened if Twitter had chosen to shut down what was happening in Ferguson. That once they saw images coming through, they said, mm-mm, this is too distressing, too disturbing enough, I'm going to shut it all down. We would have never known what was happening because the mainstream media wasn't covering it, and we were getting that information through Twitter. So I do think it's really important to recognize that Twitter is not just a place for people to just chit-chat. It can be, but much like a newspaper where you can just have like little classified ads in the back, Twitter can also have pretty meaningful conversations going on between important folks that then gets covered by mainstream media, which yes. is what happens. Unfortunately, that's what's happening. Because I think part of what happened with Azalea is that this thing happened on Twitter, then it made it to the news, then it made it to the talk show circuit, and then it made it into some magazine that other people are reading. And it originated in the Twitter space.
I think you make some great points. They're very well taken. I guess what I still feel, so if you talk about Ferguson, mm-hmm. there's so much to be outraged about what happened in Ferguson.
Sure.
Azalea Banks making several extremely ignorant comments in 140 characters or less, to me, warrants much less outrage.
Well, Jason...
Is it because of who she is? Sorry, Chris. Is it because of who she is? Because what I'm... what I want to say is that Trump does the same thing.
But Trump's running for president, and if
but that's what I'm saying.
Win,
so is it about who she is? So that's what I wanted to know.
It's
is
not
it
just
who
her.
She is?
I think it's any but like the majority of people, including celebrities, do mm-hmm. not have significant influence on public policy. Or yeah,
don't tell that to
I disagree. I disagree. What are you talking yeah. about? Wait, what's your statement again?
Celebrity doesn't have any...
I didn't say celebrity impact. Doesn't have... I said most of us, including celebrities, don't have major influence on public policy
oh, I completely
in what
disagree.
We might say in a tweet.
Oh,
don't
I
tell
dec-
that
I
to
completely
George,
disagree.
Don't tell that to George Clooney.
Yeah.
Give me an example.
Susan Sarandon.
You want to cordon off tweets in their own universe, Jason, where we can just put in the cupboard and ignore it. And I think
no,
what Trisha and I are trying to say is that we're no longer talking about just Twitter or just Snapchat or just the New York Times. We exist in a media universe, a media multiverse, and no one is just cordoned off in their own place. That even that, and to get to your point, maybe you and I don't have impact on public policy. We could, but celebrities absolutely do. Ask any gay person. Ask any gay person of a certain age where they were when they watched Ellen's coming out episode, and they will tell you vividly. Celebrities can influence public policy, and they do all of the time. You cited Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump is so persuasive in his way that he's running for fucking president. You know what I mean? Like. You can't just say that.
And he's entirely a media fiction.
Yes.
He's entirely a fiction.
So I don't know where you're going with the idea like, oh, we shouldn't pay attention to Twitter or
I didn't say
and
we
then also,
pay attention to Twitter.
You run it
not,
run
not
it
said. Twitter. Unsaid. Your statement, not mine.
I retract that. But I do think you run down problems. You run into problems and you start going down the road of like, well, Trump, yes, but Azalea Banks, no. Like I think because then that gets at the heart of my question in the first place.
I'm talking about proportionality.
Silenced.
Like,
what
I'm not
kind
talking
of
about no. It's not a yes or no. It's like, how much ink do we dedicate to this, and how much time do we dedicate to conversing about this spat on Twitter with Azalea Banks versus other things? I just think her in a spat with a couple of people saying offensive things, it's worthy of a mention. It's worthy of a condemnation. I feel like there's so many bigger fish to fry.
But always, but also the content matters, Jason, because there's some things that you can say on Twitter and not get banned, and some things you can say and you will absolutely get banned. For instance, there's a lot of spaces where you just can't say things about Jews, especially here in New York, right? And if you say a lot of things about Jews in a certain area, you will be unilaterally shut down. But you're allowed to say other things about other people. You can say whatever you want about homosexuals, say whatever you want about women. And in that way, right, the public conversation is influencing policy.
Well, I said at the very beginning, if the issue here is a double standard, I think that's a conversation worth having. And Tricia argued that there was, and I think what you said, Chris, is maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but there's another piece of this that you were more interested in exploring, which is fine. I just think a double standard is worth a lengthy conversation. Azalea Banks saying extremely ignorant things to two other celebrities, to me, is not worthy of much of a conversation.
To your point, Jason, we can have a conversation about Azalea Banks only if it maybe illuminates something that might be happening for people who are not at her level. So the larger question Chris is asking is, was she penalized because of her gender and her race? And I'm not entirely certain about that, because I believe that people who are not of her gender or her race are saying more egregious things, and I haven't seen them taken off Twitter.
Actually, my question was...
Are black actually, people excused from all
actions? Yeah, because I was... It was to quote Tricia...
No.
No, because you said, this is my favorite quote, to quote Tricia, just because Black Lives Matter doesn't mean we have to defend egregious black lives.
That sounded horrible.
That's my favorite quote. No, but you know what, though? Because this came up with the Bill Cosby thing. Like, people were like, oh, you can't take him down. He's Black America's father. And it's sort of like, but he's also a serial rapist. So what are we supposed to do with this, right? So he's a black man. He has had a lot of influence on culture. Does that mean that he gets a pass? Because that feels awkward.
And I don't think most people – I mean, on Bill Cosby
– Look, Whoopi Goldberg would disagree with you.
She and I would probably disagree on a lot of things. To me, it seems like there's near consensus that, like, his behavior is – absolutely deplorable.
Some black celebrities won't go there, or they won't comment because of this. Because
not publicly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you.
Jason, I'm very curious about what idealistic point of view you are advancing this podcast. So tell us in which way can we make the world better, but we're not. Tell us.
That is actually, I probably shouldn't even talk now because it's exactly what I was saying.
It's a thought experiment.
I'm going to run as a third party candidate, and I'm going to call my party the Idealistic Party, and it's just going to be a platform.
You might win in this election. Who knows?
I might do that. So
you just raise your hand and go, I have an idea.
Yeah.
Right. I typically don't bring – I don't choose education as one of my topics because it's my day job. I have very strong feelings about it, and this is an opportunity to explore other things. But what I'm going to introduce now is a topic that's something I would actually like to work on in my day job, but there's zero support for it, which why what you were saying, Chris, as a lead-in is exactly right. So I don't work on it, but I'm just kind of amazed that we – the question I'm posing to you two is, would our country be better off with a national education system as opposed to a gazillion little school districts with their own boards all across the country? And I'll just say it for – two rationales, although I could probably come up with more. One is, from a efficiency standpoint, every little school district has its own overhead, its own board, it costs money, it costs time. So there's that whole issue of just like how inefficient are we being as a country. And then the second one is more about effectiveness and about if we're an actual nation with, you know, federal laws that we share in common, a history we share in common, interests that we share in common, an economy we share in common. Isn't it very risky to have all these different school districts that could be using totally different curricula, totally different standards, and potentially having kids learn drastically different things, and therefore some communities, you know, kids in some communities not being well prepared to be successful or as successful in our society and our economy as others just because of the choices that little fiefdom has made?
Quick and easy answer, yeah, we should have a national education system.
Quick and easy reality, lots of reasons why we don't.
But honestly, though, I mean, I don't really understand the systematic nature of this. Why don't we? Because this is the issue, so, like, for example, in the Texas school district, right? Texas school district taken over by wacky people who don't believe in science. So now kids are reading
wacky
weird...
Wacky people, like 50% of the country, don't believe in science. Yeah.
Don't believe in science, and now they're reading textbooks that promises that they will not be able to pass any science courses in the future. So, you know, I mean, and disservice to the actual survival of the country, because guess what? You need science. It's not a choice. It's not an opinion. It's not, you know, it's like... So, I mean, in terms of science.
Another great quote from Trisha. Guess what? You need science.
You need science. Well, because to be honest, I frankly think you can make a case for national security as a real reason why you need this. Because think about it. There are going to be jobs of the future. There are going to be things that we are going to need as a country, that if you have school districts who are sort of willy-nilly dismissing important and key subjects, we're in danger.
Yes.
Right. But why don't we do it?
Love it.
Well,
why don't we do
one
it?
Of the reasons, what is the, what one is of the reasons is our America's historical animosity between the federal level and the state and local
and the
level.
State, yeah.
You know, that goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War, and they wrote a constitution that specifically gave one power over the other, but the powers are supposed to be balanced, and it's written in a very defensive point of view from the state's point of view, right? They're always afraid that the federal government will overstep.
Yeah.
So now when we talk about education, here we are. A lot of people on the local level feel like the federal government would be overstepping, and that why do my kids need to learn things that kids in Maine are learning if I'm living in Texas or Hawaii or Seattle or Miami? Add that into our general disdain for facts and our uniquely American ability to confuse fact and opinion, and you end up with the morass that we're in today. So a lot of people just feel like, you know, it starts with the religious bullshit of like creationism like the myth of creationism alongside actual provable facts. And
or at least facts that we accept in the universe.
Well, yes, but because if you don't have a really good grounding what facts are, then the conversation isn't as cut and dried as you're making it, Trisha. And I know that sounds idiotic, but unfortunately, that's where we are in the 21st century. Some people just don't agree that there are...
And I'm not even gravity
talking about
exists.
I'm not even talking about evolution. Yes. I'm talking about the way gravity and electricity works. I'm talking about people debating. I know it sounds ridiculous. I'm talking about people continually debating if maybe the Earth is flat. Like, I mean, these are extreme cases made by like extreme wackos who I think were going just for, you know, they were going for the publicity. But this is a real thing that's happening. So that's why we can't have a national education system. We are too many people. Now, I would love to know other countries who do this successfully, but not countries like small countries like the European ones when they only have like 27 million people to deal with. Like, we have 250 million people in this country. Does China have a federal? Actually, they probably do.
China has a federal everything.
I was going to say, they don't have a state or local anything.
Well, you know, it's funny you brought this up, Chris, about other countries, because one of the things that I remember reading many years ago, and it's always struck me, is that I read a piece in the New York Times from some sort of education guru from Finland, you know, Finland, where everybody loves Finland.
Everyone loves everything in Finland.
Everybody loves the education system in Finland, and they're always sending teachers from the U.S. to Finland and always talking about all sorts of things. And one of the things that the major educator said, I can't remember his name, was that, you know, I talk to Americans all the time, and I tell them all the interesting things that we're doing in Finland, but I always start out with the same exact premise that I say this needs to essentially be a part of your education system. And he says they always gloss over it and go right to the technical, you know, nitty-gritty things. And he says, in Finland, every child is receiving the exact same education regardless of where they live. And he's like, whenever I talk to American audiences, they go, whatever. So tell me, how many kids do you need to have in a classroom? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what we love to talk about here. I mean, welcome to my world. Welcome to my world. Class size will fix everything.
You know, and it's like he's always like, No. And one of the points that he made was that Finland was having sort of comparable problems to the United States in the 70s.
Right.
Until the national government said, listen, we're going to make sure that every child is getting the exact same education regardless of where they live. And if we could say that in the United States, that would be revolutionary. But in the United States, your education is like a car. It's a status symbol. And I think that's also a subtext, I think, of the national education policies, that I think we like to think about education as something that you earn based on your parents, maybe some sort of legacy, I don't know. Yes. So we're fine with, you know, having some kids gain access to great teachers, because I guess that's supposed to be a competition.
I mean, maybe on an older kid level, but I don't think anyone would argue that for younger kids.
Oh no, they do, because they blame because what I see is a trend in blaming children for their parents. So your parents were unfortunately poor, and so you deserve this thing that you have. I mean, that there's a real subtext to that in a lot of conversations around education.
That's why we need Jubilee, to go back to my last time. That's why we need Jubilee, because that breaks the intergenerational thing. I'm just stringing my idealistic.
Can we just discuss one idealistic?
Well, isn't that part of the resistance? I mean, actually, I guess it's interesting. Isn't this part of the resistance to something like No Child Left Behind, right? Because that's a federal mandate that everyone resisted, because they're like, well, we have different issues and we have different challenges, and how are we going to meet these mandates? And
bring in my day job for a second. So, I mean, the hot topic is Common Core. You have,
yes,
like Trump saying
in
the Common Core, which is absurd because it's not a federal policy. But that's the epitome of where you're going, Tricia, which is,
yeah,
in our country, a few years ago, the vast majority of states agreed to adopt common standards. Just standards, not curriculum, not like every kid's learning the same thing every day. We're not talking about Finland, just standards. And the backlash has been swift and fierce, and many states have backed off them. They're not doing them anymore. Some states have publicly said they're backing off them, but are actually doing them but calling them something different because they know that they're good, but politically it's not flying. And then you have someone like Trump who's saying he would get rid of it, which again is absurd because it's not rooted in federal policy. It's just, and it's like, well, this little thing we tried to do. What'd you say, Chris?
Well,
he also said he'll print more money to combat the debt. So let's not use Trump in these conversations.
Well, can I just also point out that I just saw something on the news this morning that said that Cleveland and Mississippi were just recently told that they must desegregate schools?
Well,
after resisting that policy, after resisting for, what, 50 years? Was it 50 years that we have Brown versus Board of Education?
45,
Cleveland.
It was 1954.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Cleveland and Mississippi were just told, quit pretending, quit playing, you got to desegregate.
Although I would hesitate to demonize them, because show me a city in the country that has desegregated schools.
No, I mean, I wouldn't demonize them. I mean,
your point,
I think.
Trisha? What are you getting at?
Well, but my point is that was a federal.
Right.
That was something that
they're resisting.
That was a federal. Mandate. Yeah, this was a federal mandate that every state, that many states fought, pushed back at, and actually, in some sense, some of them did achieve exactly what Jason just suggested, that they're still segregated, but they've just done it in a different way. They actually didn't respond to the federal mandate. So maybe requiring it at a federal level just means that you'll get a loophole and another way to figure out how to do it, right?
Can I – quick side note on this topic. I'm not going to remember the facts as well as I should, but this is especially for you, Chris, because you grew up on Long Island. So apparently I learned recently that when the Brown versus Board decision came out, there's some town neighboring Roosevelt on Long Island.
Yeah.
That because they knew that what was going to happen is they were going to have to, there was going to be busing back and forth between their white town and Roosevelt. They did something structural to their bridges that made it. I'm dead serious. Like I learned this from a former commissioner of education for the state of New York. They actually made it impossible for school buses to cross between the two towns.
I'm not that shocked, because
PBS not had a race war yet.
Like, well, you know, it's
honestly,
I'm not shocked because PBS, you know, during Black History Month, PBS did a whole thing on, I cannot, it's Alabama or some southern state, and all these tiny towns who did similar things to essentially push back at this federal mandate. It was, I mean, crazy things like shutting down the school. I mean, like, yeah. You
know? Baltimore, all the white people just sent their kids to private school. I mean,
yep.
And there's this huge private school network now in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, that actually tips off my next point. I want to run in the opposite direction of your question, Jason. So national standards for education, I think we all agree this will be an uphill battle, if not an impossibility, for the American public. But let's go small. How are there, and I'm sure there are in certain white communities, but why can't like a municipality just decide what their standards are going to be and run with it? And when they produce superior students, then wouldn't that model spread?
Mm. Well, this is my life. I mean, the quick answer is no, because
what? Why?
Well, it's very similar to what we were just talking about in terms of the reaction to Finland.
Yeah.
Like, because I mean, this is exactly what I deal with every day, where it's like, well, that city's different, and the people are poorer, or they're more affluent, or like, there's every reason why what is successful one place cannot be replicated somewhere else. So I didn't say this before. One of the things I find, if I can step back, like, this is such a huge frustration for me, but if I can step back for a second, one of the fascinating things about this is one of the few things that the right and the left, or the Democrats and Republicans, are completely on the same page about, which is local control when it comes to education. It's amazing to me, like, here in Maryland, you know, like, Maryland is a blue state. You know, the legislature's been Democrat-controlled overwhelmingly for decades. And I am telling you, if you make the slightest hint towards a statewide, we're not even talking about federal, statewide education mandate, all the Democrats start saying, local control, local control. I'm like, are you Democrats? Like, this is crazy. I'm serious. But so I think, Chris, like, there are two things. One is like, oh, that can't be replicated here. But the other is there's a constant jamming of the system in terms of the ability to assess learning.
Yeah.
No one wants to really be able to assess learning because on the Democrat side, that could lead to some teachers losing their jobs, which the Democrats are so highly subsidized by the teachers' unions, and part of their job legitimately is to ensure job security. And on the right, it's the facts thing, right? It's like, well, you know, can we really trust, you know, that this is what kids should be learning, or that test really means that? And the right and the left are totally joined at the hip on this. It's like so hard to have these conversations.
I feel like we will reach, I think that, actually, there's a whole article about people now using the term, I feel like, to obviate any criticism, and I've been trying to really clamp down on it in my own speaking. Anyway.
Wait, so you're trying to say it more or less?
Absolute less. It's such a millennium sort of touchy-feely, don't contradict me or I'll run out the room crying about my triggers, etc. It lives in that universe.
I'll give you a substitute. Start the sentence with, serious people agree that.
Oh no, because I think I'll just go back to what we used to do, which was I think that we will reach a point in society where these questions will be answered for us. There'll be some future point in society, and I don't think it's too far off. Maybe a generation, maybe less, where the kind of jobs that you're going to have to hold, the kinds of functions you're going to have to do are going to necessitate a sort of education. And people who live in Texas or the swamps of the South who want to reject things like gravity and the speed of light, they won't be able to enter society in a certain way. And, you know, I know it sounds like I'm pitching for a dystopian future. It doesn't have to be so dramatic, but I think there absolutely will be a further, deeper bifurcation of society, and this issue will resolve itself. Much in the way I had a conversation earlier today, much in the way that the record industry had to come to terms with Napster, embrace it, and now we think about music in a completely different way, and the entire industry had to shuffle along.
That's interesting.
I feel like education will have to do it at some point. So that saying, I think, Jason, your question, while not naive, I think belongs in another time. I think we have to be future casting and future forward, like trying to imagine what that new economy and society will look like and the education system that will match it. Because I don't think we can correct what's going on now. We're just progressing at such a rate culturally and socially that we have to be ready for what's next.
Well, you make a fair point, because I think in my work, casually, I'm looking at whether graduate students or whether students who are graduating with degrees are having a return on their investment. And I mean, this is the key question, right? Why go into debt? Why do what you do if what you're learning isn't actually translating into work in the current economy and the future economy? Mm-hmm. So when you say that at some level the economy is going to push us to make that distinction at some point, mm-hmm. I think it's already started. I think,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying within half a generation,
yep,
or maybe two, this is going to come to a head, and it's going to come to a head quickly though, because
I hope you're right.
Well, you look at,
I feel like it's going to come to a head, but we're going to have the same problem that we've always had, right? Which is that the people who cannot and are at the mercy of public systems will be screwed.
Yeah.
Because they will simply not get they'll simply not have the education that they need. I mean, I was just reading something recently about students who are sort of, you know, they get into college and they have been completely ill-prepared to be in college. Sure.
More than half.
Right? More than half, right? And so now you're completely unprepared for college, so most likely you're going to fail or you're going to drop out or you're going to have some weird relationship with it. Maybe you even don't finish and you end up with debt still. And then the question is you're ill-prepared for a job, so then you're always going to be behind the eight ball. And if we continue to sort of export jobs, I mean, because in some ways, this is sort of the challenge that that I think, my boyfriend Bernie Sanders is kind of raising to people, right? This illusion that you can bring back a certain type of job that no longer exists, because we live in a global world, right? And so now your skill level and your knowledge level has to be so much higher,
yes,
for you to compete in the future. What are you going to do when you don't think gravity exists or you don't know how to do math? these are pain.
You're going to have to fall in line. Like, we're talking about dystopian futures things. I mean, we have Donald Trump, like, living out this weird, ignorant fantasy that Sarah Palin dreams about, like this proud ignorance. And you're right, Tricia. The people who are going to suffer are the same people who are supporting them. Who don't know any better. And I would like to ascribe, like, really nefarious... I'd love to ascribe nefarious motives to Trump and people like Palin, but they seem like idiots themselves. But at the end of the day, the people who are going to suffer, the people without any means to move from the country or get a higher education or hear points of view other than these incredibly ignorant points of view... I don't know.
But Trump has the best words, so he's clearly...
Yeah, you need to assert over and over again that you have the best words.
I have the best words.
But I like this dystopian... I feel like you've helped us transition, Chris.
Oh, good segue.
So let's leave that... We should revisit this. Because I love talking about education. It often exasperates me, though, because I just, again, like I said, I feel like we're handling it the wrong way. We have to come to it from a future present point of view and not a present future.
Totally
we have to
agree.
Really think about what's coming
far
and
out
and work backwards.
I mean, the kids are coming in kindergarten, and like we need to be thinking about what they need in 14 years.
And we have to think about where we have to see where the economy is going and avoid that dystopian future, because I can see it happening. An entire culture of no and no nots.
That's here.
That's here, all right, and it's running for office. All right, so Tricia, why don't you take it away? Take us home with your topic.
So, this is maybe a revisit, but with hopefully new insight. I believe a couple episodes ago, we had a discussion about media representation. I believe it was the Zoe Saldana conversation about the Nina Simone biography project or movie.
Ooh, and of course, a bomb.
It's come out and bombed. However,
I didn't even know it came out. It came out.
Oh, it was exactly. Horrible.
That's what happened. So, however,
that was us, by the way. We should get all the credit for that bombing.
We should totally get. I happened to be reading someone I follow on my Facebook timeline, and he tweeted out he posted an article from The Verge, and I'm going to name the article is called Ghost in the Shell and Anime's Troubled History with Representation. And the subtopic is controversial casting is exposing the many complications and contradictions of Japanese animation. The reason why I am intrigued by this article is because it forced me to question my sort of quick and easy answer to media representation from that last podcast, where for me it was clear that a certain type of person needed to be cast in the film, and that's it. In this article, the author is questioning our resistance to the casting of Scarlett Johansson in the part of a Japanese quote-unquote character in Ghost in the Shell. And the author's contention is that in many ways, anime is a kind of Japanese appropriation of American culture that in some ways pushes back at the convenient distinction that I have in my head that this should be played by a Japanese actress. And I just wanted to know what the article brought up for you all. Did it confuse the issue for you? Did it add any sort of new questions that you didn't know you had? Or what was your sense of after reading the piece?
I have been interested in this for a while. I had met this guy who had spent time in Japan, and at the time I was really interested in anime. I'm not an anime fan, but I was interested in the representations because they're all like blonde hair and blue-eyed, and I thought it odd that a culture that's so homogenous would produce these images. And I asked him, he'd spent some time over there teaching and studying, how he, like in his interactions with Japanese people, how did they make sense? Like how did they digest these images? And what he told me, much similar to the article that we read, the Japanese don't experience the anime characters in these stories as white. They don't quite experience them as Japanese either. They experience them as a fiction. And
a fantasy.
It's a weird, it's just a fantasy slotted off in its own universe, and they're not looking to it for representation. So even though these stories take place in Japan and they have Japanese names and they're using Japanese products or whatever, or it's very sort of culturally Japanese, racially, the characters are, they aren't, it doesn't matter. Which, from an American point of view, barely computes. It's really hard for an American to parse that because so much of American culture is about fighting for your identity and having your identity recognized. In a culture where everyone looks the same, everyone sort of is the same culturally and racially, the idea of white and foreigner is often synonymous. And that puts it on a completely different plane than the way we understand when we talk about white people and their intrusion into other racial spaces.
I wanted to ask you two a quick question. I read the article. Did you watch the 6-minute video that's embedded in that article?
Yes.
Did you watch it, Trisha?
You want to describe it?
I watched it a little bit.
Oh, I
watched it.
I thought it was fascinating. So, I guess. I had never heard of him before, but this guy who is a Japanese, video blogger. I don't know what else to call him.
Yeah, blogger.
Yeah, so he did interviews in Japan where he asked young people in Japan who are familiar with Ghost in the Shell about, like, whether, you know, they thought it was weird that Scarlett Johansson was cast, whether it was problematic. It started out with, like, asking basic questions, and then he would give more context where he would then explain that, like, oh, well, in the United States, Asian and Asian American actors, there are very few roles for them, and with that in mind, should they have cast me? And it was just fascinating because just what you just said, Chris, about things don't compute for us, like, these questions did not compute for them. Like, I feel like again and again, they were like, they'd be like, oh, that's really too bad that there's discrimination. But no, I think it's fine.
Yeah, like, they took one look at Scarlett Johansson. They're like, oh, I think she'll be great in the role. And they asked these two women, they're like, yeah, you know, like, oh, she really looks the part. And when then he confronted them with, oh, they don't think she's right, the girls are looking more and they're like, is her hair too short?
Yeah, it's great. It was great. I just found it.
But to answer your question, Trisha, it really did remind me, right? Because I was going down the rabbit hole with this too, but yep. It really did remind me to take a step back and understand that our race problems here in America don't translate around the world. And the way that the world works here is not the way the world works other places. I recall, oh God, I should have thought about this before the podcast. Remember a couple of years ago where there was this big thing about boycotting Russian vodka?
Yeah.
I don't exactly remember all the details around that, but I remember here in New York City, oh, I remember what it is now. It was the whole LGBT thing.
Yeah.
When they had those Starbucks. I remember gay bars taking all their Zvedka out and onto the streets and dumping it. And I remember I posted this on Facebook, like, this is such an American thing. We are so, we understand our capitalism so much. We think we are harming the Russians by dumping the vodka, but we don't understand their system at all. And the fact that we're not actually harming the Russian government, this is not an export of theirs. That's not the way their commerce works. But we rushed to, like, well, they're punishing LGBT people. We're going to punish them by dumping all this, and you were just throwing away good vodka. I'm kidding. Svedka vodka is terrible. Swear to God, it's like
the moral of the story is,
don't drink Svedka vodka.
Hey, I want free vodka. Sorry.
I mean, you could have. You walk up and be like, you bitches are throwing all this vodka. But it's, again, the idea, like, our American sensibilities sometimes trump, and it this article reminded me of the ridiculousness of that.
Well, so I thought the article was very interesting. I think, yes, like the politics and the responses we have around representation, you know, it's fascinating how different it is compared to Japan, and anime is such an interesting medium. I still come down, I mean, to me, the root issue, well, I don't want to say the root issue. So thinking about the Nina Simone conversation we had and then thinking about this, to me, there is still a huge problem that people of color, and especially, you know, Asian and Hispanic actors, like, don't get roles. And while, you know, I think this one movie is just one tiny piece, and is it, like, such a big deal that for this one movie, like, to me, what I would like to see is studios looking for opportunities to cast people of color, including Asian and Asian American actors, in roles, and when there is such an opportunity, to take advantage of it. And I would say this movie, it seems like, was an opportunity to do that. Like, they could have done that. It's not like an American audience would have been like, this doesn't look like anime. And, like, I think it's unfortunate that they decided not to take that opportunity. You know, in that article, they also named two recent movies, which I had never even heard of, that also cast white American actors in roles that arguably the characters were Asian or half Asian. I mean, we see that done again and again and again. And it was similar to what...
Can I push back on you for a second, though? Just something that you said. You know, this reminds me of my recommendation that I made in the last podcast about, like, the cast John Cho hashtag. Yeah. Oh, God, what was the hashtag? Starring John Cho or something like that.
Sorry, John
Cho. Jason, you had said, like, you know, that studios should make the effort to hire and use Asian actors every time they have the opportunity.
I didn't say every time.
Not every time, but
they should look for opportunities and take advantage of the opportunities.
But isn't every opportunity an opportunity to cast an Asian person, it, like, we don't have to wait for Asian stories or characters that are Asian. Like, and you know, I think that's
I agree. That's a fair point.
You know what I'm saying? But it's just part of that construction. Like, just the idea that we're so focused on Ghost in the Shell and this role should have gone to an Asian woman. Well, hello, any of these roles.
No,
any
I agree
role,
with
any
you.
Movie
I totally agree.
Asian woman. So I just think it's where that we draw the battle lines around these certain, like, why?
I think that that's what actually this article did for me, was to pull me, because and I'm, of course, I'm 100% on Jason's side with this, because I'm also thinking about the just pure economics of this, mm-hmm. which is that people need to be cast in movies, and if you get an Asian part and give it to an Asian, because there are plenty of Asian actors and it won't happen. But I would think one of the things that I pulled back from this is kind of the universality of whiteness. And why? Because this is what's happening with the Japanese, right? And this is something that I was able to do as a kid, right? I could read a book as a child, knowing that the book had white people in it, but I could still see myself in the story. And I think one of the things that they, I think this is, there's a name for this, which is a kind of, what is it, literary imagination or something, where that is something that white people are not able to do. If the story is overwhelmingly about some other, many people find it difficult to enter the space because it's automatically some sort of a foreign space. So in a weird way, the article suggested that as Japanese people, they could enjoy the story seeing a person who doesn't look like them because it's still placed within the cultural milieu, right? The person is still speaking Japanese. So they can still attach themselves to the story. It's strange to me that there has never been an ability to have a universality about the experiences of people of color in movies. So that at all times, the person of color has to be particular. Do you see my drift?
Yeah,
so it's like the person of color has to be cast in this part because we know that the culture doesn't have the imagination to simply see Captain America as, say, a black guy.
Yeah.
Because suddenly, even though he could just have been raised in America, you know what I mean? Like, even though he's essentially American,
right.
There's nothing about him that makes it necessary that he needs to be blonde and blue-eyed. You know, and so, and one of the weird things that I'm finding that's happening to me lately is that I'm so hyper-conscious now of race in movies that I don't even go to see movies unless they have black people in them or people of color in them. Mm-hmm. And that's really sad to me because I used to enjoy movies without people of color in them because I could just attend to the storytelling if it was good story.
Right.
And I didn't need their race to be, I don't know, a sticking point, because I can live in that space. And so, but my retreat is really just about an economic retreat, which is like I'm punishing you because I know so many people who are trying to find jobs in that industry. And and so I'm pushing back on the kind of economics of it. But I've never had the ability, I've never lost the ability to enter a story that's fully occupied by white people and see and find some space in it. This came up recently because, you know, I actually saw another article about what is it like to watch white feminist TV if you're a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of reminded me of this article as well, which is that sometimes a storytelling can be so specific and you can be aware of its specificity and the truth of it and it's fine. But sometimes I feel like we do just a poor job of pulling out the universality of experiences if you put people of color in them.
Yeah.
Who's we? Who's we in that statement? You mean the grand we?
The grand we. The grand we. Which is why... I don't have a problem. But yeah, because you read comics. You did... I mean, we've all had experiences. We're all book readers here. And I've read... I didn't just read black books. I've read lots of books. And if I needed that person to be white or... I mean, if I needed that person to be black to enter it, I wouldn't have been reading.
Yeah, you wouldn't have read anything.
Well, but I think that's telling. I mean, this is largely constructed, right? I mean, in the United States, the world has been constructed for white people. I'm not making excuses, but that may be part of why it may be hard for us white people to enter, you know, a narrative that's occupied by a person of color is because that's not how our society has been set up. Like,
and that's the shame. And now that you guys are talking, I'm thinking about the Ghost in the Shell and our preciousness around Scarlett Johansson taking the role and our outrage about it. It's like, how come no one's outraged that I want to be outraged that Ming-Na Wen wasn't cast instead of Julia Roberts in Mother's Day?
Yep.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, right. Or it just not. As James Bond, as we were talking
about. Yeah. Why don't
be outraged about that? I totally agree.
No, but instead it's like we want to pick these particular roles and stick them in. The Doctor Strange is coming out, I think, later this fall. And there's been all that flap that Tilda Swinton is playing the role of the Ancient One, who in the comic is a Tibetan monk, a male, older Tibetan monk. And everyone's like, how dare they? This is a role that could go to an Asian actor, and they're taking away giving to a white woman. And it's like, well, to be fair, Doctor Strange, his story is that he was a New York surgeon who was in a car accident. You know, why does that have to be Benedict Cumberbatch? Why can't that be an Asian guy? So our preciousness around these roles, I think, is in its own way a bad construction. And I think as I'm talking about it, I think I'm going to start pushing back against these ideas. I think we should have representation. I mean, this article was interesting culturally. There's not a lot to learn and take from to use in our American experience because Japan is such a different culture. But I do think what we can take from it is that we as Americans, as we seek representation, continue to only define certain areas where representation makes sense. And then by doing that, we are just slotting off every other experience as in some way not making sense. And I'm going to push back against that because that's ridiculous.
You know, I feel compelled to ask this question. In the context of this conversation, what do you make of the casting in Star Wars Episode 7 of Lupita as that thousand-year-old, apparently, like, a character that looked and sounded very Asian?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not in the Star Wars universe, but I did think I've heard that there were people who had problems with that because they thought that she again was invisible in the movie because there was so much like prosthetics around her, so you didn't even really get to access her face. So people had problems with that.
I assumed she was literally not filmed. I thought it was just a voiceover. Like, character looked. No. I'm serious. I assumed she was not visible in the film.
Yeah, I mean,
Chris, you saw the film, right?
No.
You didn't see Episode 7?
No, I don't have time for Star Wars. The barrier to entry is severe.
And I hate to say it, but it's the same for me. Like, Star Wars is one of those that I'm just...
Right.
Cultural experiences that I'm going to miss. But no, I mean, I do think... But you see, this is what happens when you take a film and you only slot off three parts for everybody else. But you know what I mean? Like, all the minorities are going to have to duke it out.
No, but I brought it up. Because I found it just so... So you have a character... I mean... You know, she's a woman. She's a person on another planet. So, I mean, but, like, the character looked and sounded like a very elderly Asian, like a Chinese woman. And then they cast her, which I think she's a great actress. And, like, it's great to have her in a Star Wars film. It just seemed weird. It just seems so strange. I don't know. Anyway, we have to
see, but I think this might be too much of the preciousness that I was talking about.
No, but I'm not being precious about it. I just thought it was strange, like
because they wanted Lupita, needed a role for her.
But isn't that the preciousness? Lupita, like you have Lupita, so now that you have Lupita, then she should be representing as like this strong black woman, and this should be
that's not what I'm saying.
No.
Or the fact that she sounds Asian, like an Asian person should have done it. Like, what are you getting at?
I just think.
It's odd.
It's really – you're taking an actor who is of one minority with an accent and using her to portray someone of another minority and a different accent. It's just weird. Like, I mean, and I will also admit, and this may sound very superficial, she's also obviously very visually stunning. And I'm like, if you're going to pay her to be in the movie, like, would you want to have her appear in the movie? Anyway.
Well, you know, one of the reasons, and can I just say as an aside on this, because this is a sort of sexism issue, what I think has been really fascinating is how there's a real push towards diversity by handling gender rather than race. Because I think what people did with Star Wars, just in my reading of it and some of the things I've seen, is that they've said, hey, you want diversity? I'm giving you a girl. And it's going to be girl power. And so a lot of sort of my feminist friends were really celebrating Star Wars for that aspect. And then some of my friends who are, you know, black and into Star Wars thought that it still fell along these sort of normal tropes of the passive black character in terms of the John Boyega thing. So I just think I always think that there are all these universes, there's like multiple things happening in these spaces, and the movie industry is always trying to toggle back and forth between which one it's going to attempt to tackle. That it's never like a pure space, because the reality is, if you do get somebody like a Lupita, why wasn't she the lead?
Well, I mean, this is also could be a whole other conversation. What I find fascinating about George Lucas, and not that he had a whole lot to do with this movie, because he didn't, but, you know, if you remember the criticism of when Episode One came out and you had, like, the Jamaican...
The Jar Jar Binks?
Yeah, Jar Jar Binks, Jamaican funny clown, and you had the Jewish slave owner and stuff. Like, the thing that I find fascinating about him, I think he's married to a black woman. He's got kids of different races. Like, at some point, he made the decision that to the benefits of storytelling that resonates, like, was worth leveraging stereotypes. You know, like,
sure, for the cash, honey.
He made that decision, and criticize it, and he was kind of like, I don't give a fuck. Like, he didn't even respond, and he just continued using those characters. And I mean, you see it in all the Ewoks, like,
yeah.
Every, you know, and even in this movie. You know, the character that Lupita is playing, again, it's like this mystical elderly, I mean, it's like what you guys say about Bagger Vance, it's this mystical elderly Chinese woman who knows everything, and like, it's totally like that, and like, they just don't give a shit. I mean, they're just like, well, people respond to that, so we're just going to go.
They certainly do. I want to say on this tip, the Black Panther movie that's coming out next summer, the news says that the cast will be 90% black. And I'm curious how people are going to deal with that, Tricia, from what you said earlier, is that white audiences, they see that many black people or people of color in a movie, and they feel like they cannot enter. So it's going to be very intriguing to see how that movie does. It's going to be a real test for America, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, I think so. And I think what's always interesting is that when a movie is going to be 90% black, that's when America wants to do that weird reverse. Anyone could play this part! Moment.
What do you mean?
Usually that's when, well, now I think it's reverse racism, because 90% of the people in the movie are going to be black. Yeah. Why couldn't this part have been played
even though the movie's about an African prince and the movie takes place in Africa.
They're white Africans.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
Right.
Worse to hear about them when the movie comes out.
Exodus, Gods and Kings. Let's not talk about that.
It's going to be, I mean, this is going to be fun, because I think this is going to be related to my recommendation, by the way.
Oh, what are you, a segue machine?
Segue, yes. Oh. She just keeps throwing it in.
I'm
like, I'm going to keep this shit moving.
Yes.
Recommendations, which is a media event, something that you saw, heard, or experienced that you think other people should see, hear, experience, or, as Jason has added in recent weeks, if you have seen some, if you had a media event you think people should not see, hear, or experience, you let us know. So, Tricia, why don't you take it away?
So, in the spirit of Black Panther and 90%, so on Twitter, you all know that you can have hashtags, and hashtags can trend and just take over your Twitter feed.
Uh-huh.
So last week, black people got Black Panther So Lit trending.
Oh, I saw this.
So Black Panther So Lit is essentially kind of a celebration of the Black Panther character, as well as just the Black Panther phenomenon, the fact that it's the number one comic in the country, all of those things. So really, I would recommend you searching or Googling Black Panther So Lit and looking at all of the tweets that came out of it. Because it's just black people being so happy. They're like, Black Panther's so lit, I'm going to walk in the theater in formation. Yes. Or Black Panther's so lit, I'm going to take the whole day off and watch it 20 times. I mean, it's just, and I mean, it's like heartening, but also at the same time, I mean, it's a real, it really reveals to you this sort of hunger for stories featuring black people in a sort of powerful and showing agency and all of that stuff that's just missing. So
I want to say two things about that movie. One, it is gonna irrevocably change the life of so many young black boys.
Yes, it's like
that. It's gonna change their entire lives in a way that it almost brings me to tears because I'm a comic book fan. It's going to be a really big deal for them to see this character and then grow up and think that's super heroics. Or for them, I grew up wanting to be a superhero, and I had to do it, and I had to do it in spite of not having any role models of my own. You guys are seeing me on video right now in my bedroom. You can keep a poster behind me of the Justice League of America, and it's like all these white people. You know, this is what I was doing when I was young. The second thing I want to say is that I give it, 30 seconds before someone starts posting, why can't we have a White Panther movie?
Yeah.
Here it comes. 3, 2, 1. Everyone check Twitter. I'm sure it's there. Jason, what's your thing?
This morning I rediscovered, this will be another recommendation that annoys you for a new reason.
Here we go.
I rediscovered Whistle Fritz.
What is Whistle Fritz?
What are you saying?
What is Whistle Fritz? Tell me, what is that?
Whistle Fritz is a company that produces materials to teach young children other languages. And I was playing Whistle Fritz music in that... is in the Spanish language for my kids. First of all, it's such good music, even like just objectively. And then as a way of like teaching Spanish to kids, it's just like fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
That's really cool.
Thank you.
Yep. I don't mind that recommendation, Christopher.
No, I like that.
Okay.
I had two, but one's more of a media event, so I should go with that one, right?
Go for it.
You can say two if you want. I mean, all right, we'll allow it.
I'll say two. One's sort of like a plug slash endorsement sponsorship deal. But the first is I was reminded recently by Facebook that Donna Summer died around this time a couple of years ago. And at the time I posted this video on Facebook, which I rewatched, it was her singing Last Dance at, I think, the Nobel Prize Awards in Norway. It was hosted by like Will Smith. I think it was the same year that Obama got the award. And first of all, I love that song. It means a lot to me.
Great song.
She was just epic. And I woke up to that. I woke up to it this morning and I was in a great mood. And it just reminded me that, you know, like the song says, like, this could be your last chance to dance. And it's such a simple and sort of like treacly kind of statement. But it makes total sense to me every moment of the day.
And
I just wanted to share that. I'll post it on the page. It's just a wondrous thing to see. And there was so much joy in the audience. And I'm such a fan of joy that it just really made me happy. So I think everyone else should see it. The other media event, it's not a media event. The other thing I would say that I've really been enjoying lately, you all know I'm a big board game aficionado.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very simple game called Codenames, which was so super popular you couldn't even get it a couple of months ago, but now you can get it everywhere for like $15. It's a very easy like guessing game. Anybody of any age can play it. It's totally addictive and super fun, and it's super simple. And I think it's elegance, the elegance of it, like how simple it is. It reminds me a lot of like 70s guessing games, like television show guessing games. But anyway, it's been really great. I played it with kids as young as 8, to old people as young as old as like 50. No, I'm kidding. I was like actual old people.
Actual old people.
Actual old people.
Wow. I wonder what you're saying in 20 old years people. When we're doing this.
I know. All right, my favorite people.
Fun.
This has been fun.
Fun.
And yet again, we're all signing off. So good night, everybody.
Good night.